From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Capital punishment, due process, and the Constitution. Hello again, I'm Oren Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. The National Academy of Sciences has told a Senate committee that much of the forensic evidence used in criminal trials has never been scientifically tested. The state of Texas may have to admit it executed a man who was legally and factually innocent. The U.S. Supreme Court has agreed to review a case where new evidence allegedly shows the innocence of another condemned man. If the evidence was faulty, does the Constitution require that his life must be saved? Or does his full and free trial justify the death penalty anyway? On Reporter's Notebook later on, three highly public incidents of incivility. Is there a connection? First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org.
Hello again, Warren Olney, back with To the Point. The U.S. Supreme Court says a defendant found guilty after a fair trial does not have the same rights as a free man. Does that mean a condemned man should be put to death even if new evidence shows he was innocent? We'll hear about capital punishment, due process, and the Constitution. On Reporter's Notebook, a congressman, a tennis champion, and a hip-hop star all violate the conventions of public civility. Is it a trend? First, this news update. 1 year after the fall of Lehman Brothers, President Obama went to New York today, pushing what he called the biggest regulatory reform since the Great Depression. He told an audience, including Wall Street executives, they have an obligation to U.S. taxpayers.
They shouldered the burden of the bailout, and they are still bearing the burden of the fallout in lost jobs and lost homes and lost opportunities. It is neither right nor responsible, after you've recovered, with the help of your government, to shirk your obligation to the goal of wider recovery, a more stable system, and a more broadly shared prosperity.
Brady Dennis is financial reporter at The Washington Post. Brady, thanks a lot for being on our program.
My pleasure.
Now, the president went on to say that the Wall Street brokers that he was talking to have not learned the lessons of the collapse, the financial collapse.
It was an interesting speech today, not necessarily in what the president said, because there wasn't a whole lot new as far as his proposals, but I really thought the setting was interesting. He had a very specific audience, and there's a significance, I think, in his going to Wall Street and essentially telling people on Wall Street how he expects them to conduct their business going forward. And I think that was the main piece of interesting news from today.
Tough talk. He said, "Hear my words. We will not go back to the days of reckless behavior and unchecked excess at the heart of this crisis, where too many were motivated not only by the appetite for quick kills and only by the appetite for quick kills and bloated bonuses." So he wasn't mincing any words. But what is he specifically proposing that be done with regard to financial regulation?
Well, a whole range of things that the administration unveiled back in June. And I think, another goal of the president's today was certainly to put this issue back on the map. It's, things tend to get quiet here in Washington in August. Congress leaves, and certainly the health care debate sort of put everything else on the back burner. And so I think today he wanted this whole range of reforms that he wants Congress to take up this fall. He wanted to put the spotlight back on that, and also to command the news on a day when it's an anniversary of really the crisis last year.
When he says this, instead of learning the lessons of Lehman and the crisis from which we're still recovering, they, meaning the Wall Street people, are choosing to ignore them. What does he mean? What specific practices, was he specific about that?
I don't think he got too specific about that today. I mean, certainly there's a worry that whatever happens in Congress may or may not change the practices of Wall Street, and I think he wants to be sure that there is real reform. I think there's a fear that as time passes, it's easier to stick with the status quo or to be convinced that things may be, in retrospect, weren't so bad. And I think he was hoping to remind people today that all we went through in the last year, there need to be serious changes and less risk taken on Wall Street.
So he wants a federal consumer agency to oversee financial products. He wants expanded authority for the Fed, and he wants the government to be able to take over failing institutions and unwind them. What are the chances for those kinds of things getting through the Congress now?
Well, I mean, I think there's a decent chance for all of them. It just depends on what shape they may take. I mean, certainly a lot of banking industry folks don't like the idea of a new agency and say that it would add a new layer of government bureaucracy, and it would actually hurt more than it would help. You know, the president has proposed giving the Federal Reserve power to monitor for systemic risk in the economy, and a lot of legislators don't want to invest that power in the Federal Reserve. So there'll be debates like that. But, you know, there is consensus, I think, that some reforms really are in order.
Sounds like Republicans versus Democrats again. But what about the Blue Dog Democrats? Are they, as they are in other areas, concerned about overregulation and, as you put it, too much government?
Yeah, you know, I don't know. On some issues, it may break down on party lines. With things like the Federal Reserve's power, at least in the Senate, there's certainly some bipartisan agreement, or at least some skepticism about vesting more power in the Fed. So you may see some interesting alliances that don't always happen on other issues this fall.
The president apparently wants to get this by the end of this year. Next year, of course, is an election year, a difficult time to get anything at all. Do you think it'll be high on the agenda, given what he's doing also with the health care reform?
Well, I think it's ambitious. There's really no doubt about that. And so, you know, this goal of getting financial reform passed by the end of the year, you know, really uncertain whether that can happen. I do think to have that alongside of health care, you know, people have, while this hasn't been on the public radar screen as much as health care, certainly, people in various committees in the Senate and the House have worked on it throughout the summer. So it's not as if they've turned away completely. So, you know, I think they're certainly going to make an effort to pass this through this year.
All right. We'll see what happens. Brady Dennis, financial reporter with The Washington Post. Many thanks.
All right. Thank you.
In a moment, capital punishment, due process, and the Constitution on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warman Alney back with To the Point. Three young children died in a house fire in Corsicana, Texas in 1991. In a two-day trial, their father, Cameron Todd Willingham, was convicted of murdering them by setting the fire. Just before he was scheduled for execution in 2004, an independent investigator reported that the fire was caused by accident, not by arson, as Willingham's jury had been told. He was executed anyway. Since then, two more investigations have found no evidence of arson. One was commissioned by the state of Texas. Did the state execute an innocent man? David Gran wrote extensively about the case in a story called Trial by Fire in the New Yorker magazine. He joins us now. David Gran, thanks a lot for being on our program.
Thanks so much for having me.
Tell us, do you believe that the state of Texas executed an innocent man?
What can be said indisputably is that he was executed on the basis of no evidence. There is absolutely no evidence he committed a crime. It was based on an arson investigation in which the original investigators reached their conclusions based essentially on folklore. That being said, I do believe that Texas executed an innocent man. I spent about 8 months investigating the case, and every piece of evidence that the case was based on probing collapsed. And I also was able to access Willingham's diaries and letters over a 12-year period, and they created insight into his inner thoughts, and it would have involved a level of self-deception to read those letters, almost self-delusional, the way he maintained his innocence and described what happened to him.
You say folklore was what the case was based, or the conviction was based on. What do you mean? A lot of people who were supposed to be arson investigators, experts in that area, testified at the trial.
That's right. The fire broke out on December 23rd of 1991, and Cameron Todd Willingham lived in a small house with his wife, three children. The wife had left that morning, and Cameron Todd Willingham was later seen on his porch of his house. He had covered in soot, and he was screaming, "My babies are burning up." The firemen eventually came, put out the fire, and the three children perished. Arson investigators then came to the house and began to investigate the fire, and they found what they believed were clear indicators of arson. They found what they called or referred to as pour patterns or puddle configurations, which looked like where if somebody had poured some kind of liquid accelerant like gasoline or charcoal lighter fluid, that the fire concentrated in those spots, leaving these irregular patterns. They also saw what they believed was another indicator of arson, and that was called crazed glass. They believe that when someone used charcoal lighter fluid or gasoline, it caused the fire to accelerate very quickly, which created this strange, almost spiderweb-like pattern in the glass. All these indicators, and they cited about 20 indicators of arson, have now all been revealed through scientific testing to be based simply on folklore or to be invalid and not to based on the actual fire of science. For example, that spiderweb little pattern, it's not caused from a liquid accelerant. It's actually caused not from rapid heating, but rapid cooling, so that when the firemen come to the house and they shoot sprays of water on the glass, thermal shock creates that pattern. So all these indicators, which were so powerful at Todd Willingham's trial, were based either on, you know, had no scientific basis, essentially.
So, again, then, you conclude, and well, I guess I should say this. Why do you believe the people who critiqued the arson investigators rather than the arson investigators themselves?
Yes. And I should say this, which is very important. I don't think those original investigators went in there intending to do anything wrong and clearly believed that was the case. The problem was that the science of arson was still very undeveloped, and that what they believed was arson was something that arson investigators for decades had testified in court to. But there's been a revolution in science since then, where most of these theories have all been tested in laboratories and been studied, and there's been extensive research, and they've revealed all these old theories to be no more than witchcraft. And all the leading science investigators who have looked at this case, not just one also from one particular point of view across the spectrum, fire experts who testify more for the prosecution, fire experts who testify more for the defense, they've all concluded and reviewed this case and concluded that there is no evidence to indicate that the fire was intentionally set.
David Grann, again, staff writer for The New Yorker magazine, spent 8 months working on this story about Cameron Todd Willingham being executed by the state of Texas. Barry Mattson is deputy director of the Alabama District Attorney's Association. He's the chief prosecutor for the Alabama Computer Forensic Laboratories, served for over 16 years as a chief deputy district attorney in Talladega County, Alabama. And Mr. Mattson, thank you very much for joining our program.
Thank you, Mr. Olney. Glad to be here.
What's your take on what happened in this Texas case? Do you agree that an innocent man was executed?
It's very difficult to sit back and armchair quarterback something that happened that long ago, and which is exactly what Mr. Grann and others would do in a case like this. What you have to understand, and I hope the listeners understand too, is that articles like this, Mr. Grant is a fantastic writer, and it's very well written, but it's intended to drive public opinion. And when you look at the article and you look at, first of all, the opponents of using certain forensic science disciplines need a case like this to be able to attack these types of convictions. There are several things.
You mean essentially death penalty convictions?
Oh, certainly death penalty or any conviction. I mean, we spent last week before Congress talking about the Nash report, which is now will attack all forensic sciences, not just fire examinations, but fingerprints and ballistics, anything of that nature, because they want to create reasonable doubt in these cases, in cases where there really is not any reasonable doubt. See, the cases like this, particularly the Willingham case, they're not tried in a vacuum. a courtroom, a trial is a living, breathing thing. And there are things in this case besides this forensic evidence, which, interesting enough, I think Mr. Gann and others want to attack the fire examination's expert testimony by using other fire examination expert testimony and still say that expert testimony is not reliable. You can't have one without the other. But in this case, there's lots of things that were left out from the article that are really pertinent to this conviction. For instance, the fact that Amber had burns on the soles of her feet. She was in the bed that her father was said he was sleeping in. Yet he had no burns on the soles of his feet. He had to trod through the same path that she came to go to his bedroom, if in fact that happened. There's lots of things, that eyewitness testimony of other witnesses that observed this Mr. Willingham after the fire. Now, if you look at the article, and again, I applaud Mr. Grant. He has the article is very well written. But if you look at the portions where he gives you, he says, okay, eyewitnesses said X, Y, and Z about Mr. Willingham. He immediately follows with a paragraph that says, oh, but this is not reliable because. Then when he talks about the informant who said that Mr. Grant admitted to him that he had done this, that's followed by a paragraph that says the same thing. So, it's intended to drive public opinion. We understand that. I just want the public to understand that there's two sides to these stories.
David Grand, back to you. We could spend the entire program arguing these particular issues, and we don't have time for it. But let me ask you, were you, in fact, trying to drive public opinion on the death penalty particularly?
It's absolutely absurd. Before I did this story, I was extremely skeptical, and I did not have a strong opinion on the death penalty. If anything, I was probably sympathetic to it. The idea that one would go in and research a story and reach those conclusions based on some predetermined thing is just simply not true. I examined every single piece of evidence in the case, including a lot of evidence which wasn't presented to the jury. And the idea that two experts are equivalent in knowledge is just simply an absurd notion. Just because a fire scientist testifies in court but has almost no education or understanding of fire dynamics, that doesn't make him an expert. The people who are reviewing these cases are not armchair critics. They are the top leading forensic fire scientists in the country who have all done extensive research, have PhDs in chemistry, and actually test these theories in laboratories. The people who had originally testified in the case had almost no knowledge or comprehension of fire dynamics. They had conducted no experiments. It was simply based on the wisdom that had been passed down from generations. So to create a moral equivalency is simply false. And the idea that every story has two sides, well, sure, I mean, the prosecution had a side, and I presented every piece of evidence, but two sides aren't necessarily true. There is an objective truth that can be reached in this case.
Barry Mattson, back to you in Alabama. You mentioned a moment ago the National Academy of Sciences report to a U.S. Senate committee, which you testified about last week. Are you concerned that there is an effort to try to raise questions about all forensic evidence used in criminal trials, as that National Academy of Sciences report did?
Certainly. What we have to understand is that the only person charged in the criminal justice system with seeking the truth and doing what is right is the prosecution. The defense, in any case, whether it's post-conviction or during the trial phase, their job is to be a mouthpiece for their client. And they are used, and that's their goal. That's what, and I don't begrudge them that. That's the system that we have. I put forth the evidence, and they look for holes. The stronger and more vigorous defense there is, the more stronger and that I am to pursue the truth in the case. But you have to understand also that what they have done is, I think, if you look at the Innocence Project, 75% of the cases that they've had involving forensic sciences were hair and serology from years ago. 65% of those cases occurred 20 or more years ago. They're running out of those cases. There's no more hair comparison or serology cases. They're all DNA cases. So the next level, the next case, the next big shtick is going to be attacking other forensic sciences. And they want them validated pursuant to some validation that they deem to be necessary or they deem to be pertinent, and that very well may be the case. But what you have to understand is just because it's not been validated by some study in some, you know, university somewhere does not mean that they're not valid just because they've not met those rigorous standards. At some point in time, they will, and most of them have, but does not mean that those particular techniques are not valid. And they're being attacked every day across this country using this report, which is erroneous.
Again, Barry Mattson is Deputy District Attorney in Talladega County, Alabama. You mentioned the Innocence Project. Peter Neufeld is co-director of the Innocence Project. That's at the Cardozo School of Law at Yeshiva University in New York. And Peter Neufeld, welcome to you.
Hi.
What do you have to say about the challenges by yourself and by the National Academy of Sciences to forensic evidence that has been used and used so often, as Barry Mattson indicates, to convict people all over the country?
Well, actually, my challenge is irrelevant, as is Mr. Mattson's. We're simply lawyers. The National Academy of Science report is a blue ribbon commission of scientists and forensic scientists who reviewed, at least a dozen or more different forensic disciplines that have been used for years and years and years to convict people and send people to death. And they determined that most of these disciplines had never been properly validated scientifically. Mr. Mattson's suggestion that that doesn't make a difference in terms of its usability in a court of law is actually somewhat scary. It's all we're talking about for forensic science is requiring the same type of validity and reliability that we require as a nation for medical devices and different drugs that are used for medical purposes. We don't allow the consumer public to be subjected to them until they've been validated. And similarly, you shouldn't have people's life and liberty at stake unless those systems have been validated. Probably the worst part of it is that we have 243 cases at the Innocence Project where people relied on other types of evidence to convict them, and then we were able to demonstrate to a moral certainty that they were factually innocent years after the conviction. In a lot of those cases, less reliable forms of forensic science than DNA were used to convict people, disciplines such as arson, bite marks, hair microscopy, even fingerprints. And all we're simply saying is, my God, we've been doing this for too long in a sort of slapdash way, and when such serious issues are at stake, we better get it right scientifically.
Back to Barry Mattson. If, in fact, you as a prosecutor, as you indicated, are the one person in the trial that's supposed to be seeking the truth, wouldn't scientific evidence be more important to you than anybody else?
It's very interesting that Mr. Gianelli and Mr. Neufeld also back in 1992 issued a study. There's an article in the New York Times where they opposed the imposition or introduction of DNA evidence. It was prosecutors in this country that fought every day in the trenches at the being posed by defense lawyers to get DNA evidence to the level that it is today. That's who got evidence in and got DNA evidence in this country.
But now you seem to be opposing the scientific investigation of these other kinds of forensic evidence, which Mr. Neufeld finds scary. What do you say to that?
Absolutely not, and I don't think it's scary at all. I'm not opposed to any validation. I'm not opposed to any accreditation or certification of those sciences, but I don't think we should throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Again, Barry Mattson is a deputy district attorney in Talladega County, Alabama. We're going to come back and continue this conversation with David Grand, Barry Mattson, Peter Neufeld. We'll also hear from Dahlia Lithwick at Slate.com about another case that is now being considered by the U.S. Supreme Court, a death penalty case where it is alleged that new evidence shows that the convict was not, in fact, convicted on evidence that that is scientifically provable. He hasn't been executed as yet. On Reporter's Notebook a bit later, public rudeness in Congress, at the U.S. Tennis Open, and at the MTV Music Awards. What's behind it? Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
Warman Olney back with To the Point, talking today about traditional forensic evidence used in court to try people for all kinds of crimes. And including those that make them eligible if convicted for the death penalty. I want to go back to David Grand, our first guest, who wrote Trial by Fire, the story about the Texas execution. Did the authorities, parole authorities in Texas, take a look at all at the new evidence that had been presented to suggest that the man convicted and ultimately executed was innocent?
throughout this case, there were systemic breakdowns. He was convicted in 1992, and shortly before his execution in 2004, a top forensic fire scientist reviewed the case and had concluded that the theories that the prosecution and the original arson experts had used were no longer valid, that they had been invalidated by scientific testing. This report was sent to the clemency board as well as to the governor, and there is no evidence that the report was debated or that there was a hearing held on it, and the execution went forward. And then subsequent to his execution, other leading scientists have reviewed the case as well and concurred with that expert and that there was no scientific basis to conclude there was arson. And I just wanted to say one thing in response to what Barry said, is that in a case like this, I find it hard to understand that it's just a sigh. What should matter is the truth, wherever it may fall. And it shouldn't be a question of whether one is criticizing the prosecution or criticizing the defense. What matters is finding out the truth and dealing with its repercussions. And if an innocent person was executed, it's a great tragedy, and it should be studied so the system can be improved and not simply ignored reflexively.
Did people on the clemency board, were you able to interview people on the clemency board? And if so, what did they tell you?
I did. Essentially, they said that they don't hold hearings, even though in their bylaws they can. And they essentially said that they don't have the infrastructure or the mechanism to vet these reports. And I was able to obtain various documents which showed that they essentially didn't even hold a hearing to debate the case and sent in the responses by faxes on different days, each member voting. And the vote was unanimous, 15-0, to continue with the execution.
David Grant of the New Yorker magazine. Back to Barry Mattson. I have said several times he was chief deputy district attorney in Talladega County, Alabama. That was true for 16 years. He's now the chief prosecutor for the Alabama Computer Forensic Laboratories. We don't have time to go into what that is, but I want to be correct about your title. The former chief justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, Sandra Day O'Connor, said that the execution of a legally and factually innocent person would be a constitutionally intolerable event. Following up on what David Grand just said, I presume you agree with that.
Oh, certainly. And I also agree with Justice Scalia, who issued the challenge that there has not been someone who is factually innocent that has been executed as well.
Well, that's one of the reasons we wanted to talk about this particular case in Texas, because people are saying that this may be the first such case that has turned up.
Certainly, and I do. I think there's several issues and several things here that we can all agree on. The thing that disturbs me is, and I don't have any issue with any serious critique of forensic sciences or anything that the prosecution does. I really don't, and I don't think any prosecutor in this country does. The issue that I have is when I read an article like this, like I said, it's very well written, but there are issues in this article that are left out that are intended to motivate an issue, and if we can just acknowledge that, then I think we can move forward, because there are other issues that are just as important in this case. For instance,
Mr. Graham doesn't acknowledge that. He says he wrote the article as a skeptic and, in fact, somewhat something of a supporter of the death penalty.
And I appreciate his position and his point that he's trying to make. But if you look at the article, Mr. Vasquez, he talks about the fire investigator, that his mood darkened as he followed the burn trail, and that he details issues in Willingham's diary. Certainly those may be pertinent to him as the writer of the article, but how does what Willingham wrote over the years in the penitentiary have anything to do about the factual innocence of him at the time of the crime was committed? Also, if you look at the conclusion of, he quotes the final words of Willingham prior to his execution, which are very moving. He actually attempts to quote some portion of the scripture, but he does leave out the last quote that Willingham apparently said to to Stacy, his estranged wife, who was with him during the trial, who believed him, but who in later years came to believe of his guilt. He looked to her and I said, "I hope you rot in hell," and followed that with an expletive. That's left out of the final quote of the article. Why, I don't know. But
Well, let's find out. David Grand, what do you say to that?
Yeah, let me just answer that really quickly. In terms of the diaries and the letters, you're right. I mean, I would never rely on those as evidence. I just found them interesting into his psychology. I spent 8 months. I reviewed every single same with his final words and what he said, whether it was moving or not moving. That's also irrelevant to his innocence or guilt. The only thing that matters was the evidence that was used to convict him, and I doubt very much that Barry has reviewed the case closely. I investigate every piece of evidence. There were three main pieces. There was the fire evidence. That was the bulk of the case. And every leading expert has now looked at that case and concluded there was no evidence of arson. That's not my belief. That's their belief, and that's me simply reporting it. The other element of the case was a jailhouse informant. That was the other critical piece of evidence that was used against him in his trial. And that jailhouse informant is extraordinarily mentally unstable, and in his interview with me came extremely close to recanting and even asked me when the statute of perjury expired. Those are just facts. And then the final piece of evidence, which was much less substantial, was the eyewitness testimony, which I show changed over a period. Those were the three stools on which that case was based. It wasn't based, you're right, on his diaries, and it wasn't based on what he said before he died. And that's the evidence. And if the evidence doesn't hold, what you can say conclusively on each piece of those evidence is that they're no longer stand up.
So you were looking for drama when you wrote at the end of the piece, you quoted this very moving comment, a sort of paraphrase of the Bible, and left out what Mr. Mattson contends the condemned man said to his wife.
There's two things. One is he became angry at his wife, and there's not a really good transcript of what exactly transpired there, but at that point, it's not relevant. I mentioned that his wife came to the execution and concluded he was guilty. When he saw her there witnessing that, he became upset. And that's in the piece, that the wife concluded that.
Okay. Again, David Granton is the staff writer for The New Yorker, and the piece in question is called Trial by Fire in last week's edition. I want to move on, and Barry Mattson, again, as I said, we could be arguing this particular case all day, but there's another case which has arisen which is very important to this conversation, and that's the case of Troy Davis. Dahlia Lithwick is senior editor and legal correspondent at Slate.com. Always good to have you on our program.
Thank you for having me, Warren.
Tell us about the Troy Davis case and what it has to do with this whole issue of execution of people who are convicted on forensic evidence that's later, or some kind of evidence that's later refuted.
Well, it was just a very interesting piece of timing that at about the time David's piece came out in The New Yorker, the Supreme Court had issued this very, very surprising order, the likes of which no one had ever seen before, where they, in effect, ordered an entire new evidentiary hearing for Troy Davis, who was sentenced to death for the murder of a police officer in Georgia. And Troy Davis has been claiming that 7 of the 9 eyewitnesses who put him on death row have recanted. He's making a claim of actual innocence. And I should add that one of the 9 witnesses who hasn't recanted is, in fact, now the prime suspect. It's not that they're two witnesses, you know, rock-solid witnesses against him still. What happened was, this isn't a claim that there were some sort of procedural problems in the trial. This is a claim of actual factual innocence. And the Supreme Court, as I said, in this very, very groundbreaking order on August 17th, said, you know what, Georgia court, look at this again. We want you to have an evidentiary hearing where you look at Troy Davis's claim that his witnesses have all recanted and he shouldn't be put to death.
But the court, as so often is the case, appears to be sharply divided.
It's sharply divided, and there was a very, very dramatic dissent that was written by Antonin Scalia on behalf of Scalia and Clarence Thomas, where Scalia not only said, you know, this is outrageous and this is, you know, this is a huge mistake, but he actually went on to say, and this was quite dramatic, he said, this court has never held that the Constitution forbids the execution of a convicted defendant who has had a full and fair trial but is later able to convince a habeas court that he is actually innocent. In other words, what Scalia was writing was, this court doesn't think there's a constitutional right for the factually innocent to be spared from execution. If they've had a trial, and then he cites this new statute that really curbs, I think, the rights of folks on death row to re-examine new evidence. He cites that, and he says that this is a flagrant violation of that statute. But he goes on to say there's nothing in the Constitution, and the court has never found anything in the Constitution, that gives Troy Davis a right to have a court take a new look at the claims that he is factually innocent. And it was a very dramatic dissent and caused kind of a lot of, I think, chatter about, oh, my God, is it possible that we have a constitution that doesn't protect the innocent from being put to death?
Doesn't the Justice Scalia use quotation marks in that statement that suggest that he himself is calling into question whether this new evidence is really more persuasive than the evidence that was used in the trial?
Right. Well, he uses actually quotations around the word actually. And in effect, he's having a fight. He's been having a fight for several years now with his colleagues on the court about these claims that the Death Penalty Project makes and the Innocence Project makes that factually innocent people have been put to death. Scalia had a very interesting clash in a 2005 case that actually had nothing to do with these issues. He had a very interesting clash with David Souter, who is making the argument that you're hearing today, that we really need to look a lot harder at what we're doing before we put people to death. And at the time, Scalia was very, very offended and wrote an opinion saying, we have never put an innocent person to death in this country. And if you look at those studies, they're horrible and manipulative and wrong. So this fight has been going on for a long time, and now we're sort of even hearing it on this very program, this fundamental factual question about whether factually innocent people have died.
What about the Chief Justice? What has he had to say about it?
Well, we don't know on this particular issue. What we do know is what the last Chief Justice said, William Rehnquist, in a 1993 case where they, in fact, let the accused go to the death chamber. But 1993, William Rehnquist wrote that it may be, in his view, unconstitutional to execute someone with what he called, quote, truly persuasive demonstration of innocence. So what he was doing was holding the door open and saying, if someone comes along with a really persuasive claim that they are not the guy, it may be unconstitutional. We're going to hold that question open for another day. So really what we saw happen in August was Scalia sort of slamming the door shut on Rehnquist's caveat.
On the other hand, Roberts has also said that a person who has been convicted in a case that is full and fair, as I believe was the phrase, then he doesn't have the same rights as anybody else. And that goes to the question of whether he can appeal to have a rehearing based on DNA evidence.
Right. That was from the Osborne case, the DNA case that came down in the spring. It's not directly on point, but yes, I think it goes to the essential point that Scalia's making, that something happens after you have a trial. Something happens that makes you have less rights than you had before. And of course, that leads you into this catch-22, which is, if the something at your trial that convicted you was wrong, then how is it possible that you can be guilty based on wrong procedures or wrong evidence? So we're in a loop now in this country in terms of how we're going to untangle that. There are all sorts of normative questions, and we're talking about them today, about what happens. Do we really want to call into question all these convictions? Is it a good thing to fling open the prison doors and let everyone out? Those are normative questions. I think David Gann's point and my point is there is a fundamental problem with the way that we are putting people onto death row, and put aside the normative questions about how we fix it and what it's going to do to the system to fix it. Should we execute people when there are really legitimate questions about the procedures that put them there?
Dahlia Lithwick, again, senior editor and legal correspondent at Slate.com. Back to Peter Newfield with the Innocence Project, very involved in all of this. We're now on the issue of eyewitnesses in the Troy Davis case. 7 of 9 have recanted. One of the two who haven't is now the prime suspect, according to Dahlia Lithwick. What about eyewitness testimony? That's certainly something that's been relied on by courts and juries for a long, long time. How reliable is it?
Well, put it this way. Of the 243 people who have been exonerated through post-conviction DNA testing, eyewitness testimony, or as it turns out, erroneous eyewitness testimony, played a key role in their conviction in more than 80% of the cases. It's very troubling that Justice Scalia would suggest that once you've had this hearing where all the procedures were afforded to you, there's no ultimate review, if you will, on the question of innocence. 17 of our 243 exonerations were people from death row. In fact, 70 of the 243 involved murder cases, although many of those cases occurred in jurisdictions where they didn't have capital punishment. The point is, in all those cases, these defendants had exhausted all their appellate remedies, had exhausted all their post-conviction challenges, and had it not been for the serendipitous intervention of DNA testing, they would have been executed. There's no question about it. Sometimes the only way they got the testing was because a prosecutor consented to testing because they couldn't get it through a court order. Sometimes they got it because a judge was courageous enough to say, I don't care what the legal precedent is. If this person is innocent, he should have an opportunity to prove it.
Back to Dahlia Lithwick. When is the Troy Davis case scheduled to come up before the Supreme Court?
Well, this has gone all the way back to the trial court, to the federal trial court in Georgia. So only 2 weeks after the Supreme Court order, the trial judge started ordering the parties in the case to re-examine these issues, essentially to put on all their evidence. So this is going to take, I think, at least 2 months now for it all to be accumulated. So I don't think this is on the fast track to the Supreme Court. I think that the really critical thing that the Supreme Court did, they did already, which is order this new evidentiary hearing.
So that's at the lower court, then that could be appealed, and it could be a long time before it reached the Supreme Court, if in fact it ever did.
That's right.
Barry Mattson, back to you in Alabama. I forget which it was, legal scholar it was, who said that it's worse to convict one innocent person than it is to let many guilty ones go free. That certainly would be even more true with regard to executions, would it not? Do you think it's appropriate for the Troy Davis case to have the evidence reviewed?
Warren, that particular case I'm not familiar with. I do know that if there were seven eyewitnesses at trial, I would imagine there was other corroborative evidence. And Mr. Newfield was right earlier when he said that he and I were not scientists, that we are lawyers. But, you know, I have for 16 years, 2 to 3 jury trials a month for 16, 17 years. And I understand that trials are something not tried in a vacuum. When you listen to what he says and what the other interviewees say in our interview here, you've got to parse the words. You've got to look for when they say that eyewitness testimony played a role. Typically, when you have eyewitness testimony, and I would suspect, I don't know the facts of Troy Davis' case, much like the other interviewee does, but I would suspect that there's other corroborative evidence in that case. And
well, let me ask. Dahlia Lithwick, you said 7 of 9 witnesses had recanted, but what other evidence was brought forward?
No physical evidence in the trial, and they never found the weapon.
So nothing but the eyewitnesses? That was the sole reason for convicting the defendant?
That's what I understand to be the case.
Okay. Mr. Mattson, may that make a difference?
Certainly. If that's all there was in the case, you would want one witness to corroborate the others. If they've recanted, she says that the courts have granted a rehearing. It sounds like the system's working.
Okay. We're going to leave it at that, and we'll see how well the system does work as time goes forward. Good to have all of you with us. Barry Mattson again, and now the chief prosecutor for the Alabama Computer Forensic Laboratories, Dahlia Lithwick with Slate.com, Peter Newfield with the Innocence Project, and David Gran with the New Yorker magazine. Thanks to all of you very much for being on our program today. The hallowed venue of a joint session of Congress, the highly competitive U.S. Open tennis tournament, and last night's MTV Video Music Awards, all of them produced outbursts of public distemper in the past few days. Is there any connection? More in a moment on To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/to the point.
We're only back for the reporter's notebook on To the Point. Republican Congressman Joe Wilson yelled, "You lie," at President Obama. Tennis star Serena Williams threatened an official who said she stepped over a line. And hip-hopper Kanye West interrupted a country singer Taylor Swift's acceptance speech to say that Beyoncé should have won the MTV Award for Best Video. Nancy Snow is professor of public diplomacy at the Newhouse School of Public Communications at Syracuse University. And Professor, thanks for being on our program.
Thank you, Warren.
We're into a water cooler conversation, I think, here, but there are some serious issues involved with all of these, and there have been concerns about whether or not some action should be taken in these cases. What do you think?
Well, you know, to try to lump them all together is difficult because in the case of Kanye, as I watched the video, I didn't see it live. I saw the Serena incident live. With Kanye, you wonder if he had that planned out, that should Taylor Swift win that he was going to make a statement, that he obviously favored Beyonce. So, in the Video Music Awards, you always expect something outlandish.
Well, in fact, people have said that Taylor Swift emerged after Beyonce got her award and opened it up to Taylor Swift, seemingly quite prepared. So there have been staged cases of this before. Do you think this was one of them?
This may have been, and I think Beyonce saved the day, but it did get us talking about it today.
Yeah.
In the case of Serena, clearly I don't think that was planned, although you wonder, there's some speculation now there may be much bigger fines. But in a way, she actually brought a lot more attention to women's tennis. I think a lot more people are watching the women's doubles finals today because of it, watching to see how she'll act. Will she say something? And so it's inadvertently bringing more attention. And I think it really speaks to the nature of the media beast now. There's so much fragmentation in the media. There's so much niche media that people are scrambling to get their voices heard, and they're pushing the envelope. They're having to do something outrageous in order to be heard. And this is what Joe Wilson, we've seen in his case, he's been able to raise so much money, as has his Democratic opponent. But they're about neck and neck in the money race now there in South Carolina. So you really wonder then, I mean, I was told earlier today, regarding my own scholarship, a friend was joking with me and said, gee, you're just going to have to do something outrageous to get people to pay attention to your work. And I thought, is that really what it's come to? So we really need to think about what is the value in civility and composure. And I'd say take a page out of the president's handbook. I mean, composure is really what helped him to win the presidency. It's his calm and his coolness under a great deal of pressure that is the best exemplar. In fact, I think he should have spoken about it to the kids last week in his school address.
If I were a certain kind of broadcaster, I suppose I would invite you to say something outrageous and
get
a bigger audience
for
to the point. I understand today that Serena Williams now has issued a direct apology to the lineswoman that she allegedly threatened yesterday. That's something new and different. Are you surprised by that?
Well, no, not really. And the way that she parsed it, it was clearly sort of a PR statement. I want to amend my press statement of yesterday. I think there's probably more for her to say on the matter. You know, the lines judge is an unknown, and I read one blogger's comments where he really said that the big story was not Serena, but the fact that the USTA is protecting this lines judge, that she has not been named. They took her off the court yesterday. She's not been seen again at the U.S. Open. And I don't agree with that at all. I think that the issue still remains with Serena. She just released a book with Simon & Schuster, got a lot of attention, Queen of the Court. She's going to be going out there more, probably, possibly going on a book tour. There may be a great deal of interest in her now. But if you're going to call yourself Queen of the Court, then you have to really maintain a certain dignity on the court. And it's one thing, too, Warren, to talk about passion, because her initial apology was, look, I'm passionate, I'm known for this. And she really didn't seem to make that link to really such an extreme threatening gesture and, of course, plenty of profanity that she used against this woman. It was just shocking to see it live, and I knew that it would be a huge story. But I think it's important that we look at these and look at it in a larger context. Are we really entering a time? Have we been in this time of this lack of civility, of these culture wars, or is this something that it's much ado about nothing? I can tell you, working with a lot of young people, I make a point to talk about civility and discourse, because a lot of the topics that I address in the classroom are very provocative. I teach a course on war, media, and propaganda. You can imagine we've had all kinds of discussions about whether or not we should remain in Afghanistan, whether or not it was right to go to the war in Iraq. And furthermore, Joe Wilson's comment, you lie. I remember one of my students last week said, frankly, I wish somebody had said that when Bush was president. And he really thought that there should have been more of such outbursts, because we didn't have enough really critical discourse. But I think you have to take some measure of getting your point across without going on these personal attacks.
You have a book of your own, Persuader in Chief, Global Opinion and Public Diplomacy in the Age of Obama. You mentioned the president before and how calm and cool he is. But is this an international fact, and does it really have to do with the omnipresence now of the media and all kinds of media everywhere in the world?
Well, I mean, are you saying that you don't think the president has a teachable moment here? In this case, I think he does. I don't know whether it would be not another beer summit, but nevertheless, you know, he got a lot of points. They're showing some movement in the polls around health care reform, and I think in part it was because he was making his case, and he was interrupted, and he could have handled that differently, but once again, this has really become a trademark of Obama, and I think it drew in people. As I said, there are still these political divisions, and so there are plenty of people saying, yeah, you keep at it, Joe Wilson. And Wilson has said he's not going to keep apologizing, too. But I think that there is, you know, the whole world is watching, whether it's a sports event, the Video Music Awards. These are global events now, the U.S. Open, major Grand Slam. And of course, everybody watches what the president says all the time. So I think there's an opportunity here to remember that you can be dissenting, you can get your point of view across, but what happened to the old-fashioned manners? I have a rule which is WWMT. You know, what would Mom think? What would Dad think? What
All
would
right.
this think? So I think you need to be, and even Kanye pointed out his mother in his apology.
Okay, we're out of time. You were obviously well-raised. Nancy Snow at the Syracuse University. Today's program produced by Andrea Brody with Sonia Geis and Carolyn Radziner. I'm Warman Alney. Join us again for To the Point.
PRI, Public Radio International.